Tired of fighting your kids to make their bed? Say hello to Betty's. The unique design lets your kids make their bed with just a zip. Our patented bedding includes everything you need, a fitted sheet, top sheet, and comforter in one seamless piece that zips together. Kids love the feeling of accomplishment when they can make their bed by themselves every day. Make your mornings easier and visit Beddys.com. That's Beddys.com.
You're listening to WCOM LP 103.5 FM, Carborough and Chapel Hill. It's a Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, and that only means one thing. It's time for another round of Snarky Faith with your host, Stuart Deloney. This is a space where we irreverently wrestle through life, culture, and spirituality, all with our heads in the clouds, our tongues in our cheeks, our hearts in our sleeves, and our feet on the ground. At Snarky Faith, the questions, or even the answers, are never the point. It's all about the conversation. So here's your host, Stuart Deloney.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to another round of Snarky Faith Radio. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney. And for those of you listening to us live and on the air right now, I want to wish everybody a happy 4th of July. And what we are doing today is a little different than usual. I sat down with a friend of mine, Max from the Bronx, to talk about Max's journey in and out of faith. I believe this is a very interesting topic, and I think it's something that it's fascinating to be able to hear people's personal stories. So without further ado, let's go ahead and listen to my talk that I had with Max. Thanks so much. Well, I'm sitting here today talking with my friend, Max from the Bronx, and what I want this to look like for this next while as we're talking is we're really just going to lay out a conversation here. Max has a very interesting past. And we just want to kind of delve into his story. We want to kind of get a little deeper into his story, because I think that for our listeners here today, that Max has a story that's worth telling. So welcome here, Max.
Hey there, Stuart. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Max. So I want to begin to frame this whole conversation that we have here really centered around this. And so tell me if I'm getting this right, and then we'll dig into your story. You were raised in an Orthodox community, is that correct? An Orthodox Jewish community.
An Orthodox Jewish community called Riverdale in the south section of the Bronx in Manhattan.
And so you've had, through your life, you've kind of had a journey of belief, of disbelief, of belief, and then back again to disbelief. Is that fair to say?
That is the perfect flow, exactly that, yeah.
So tell me about this. So, because I find your story fascinating, and I know I've had the benefit of being able to hear snippets of your story offline. But you grew up in a Orthodox Jewish community. Now, before we even get to your story, tell us a little about your parents and how they ended up there.
Right. So my parents were born in Riverdale. Riverdale is, like I said before, south part of the Bronx, not that far from Yankee Stadium, actually, but a small, you know, upper class enclave in the, you know, quite frighteningly known area of the South Bronx. They were born there, and their parents moved there in the early 20th century, actually in an attempt to escape the mass killings in Russia. My grandparents were born in Khusk in Vilna, and when the pogroms were happening there, they, you know, felt as though they needed to escape, obviously. So they took ships to Hamburg and to Berlin. One of them was actually called the Blücher, where they met quite a few other Jewish families, and they all landed in Riverdale. And they worked in Harlem, they worked in Brooklyn, and they, you know, found a little community in Riverdale where they felt accepted, because, you know, yes, they lived in a Jewish community in their Russian, you know, farms, but, you know, during that time you had the czarist Russians and the imperialists come and murder all their family and all their, you know, friends. So they landed up in Riverdale, made a life there, and my parents were born there, and I was born there too, and hopefully my children will be born there as well.
Really? So you see yourself eventually going back?
Oh yeah. I always say that New York is my home and my heart, and Riverdale is where my soul is. It is, although I don't believe in a soul, it, you know, metaphorically, it is one of the most amazing places that I can, you know, even conceptualize. Hmm.
And so we'll get more to where you're at now a little bit later in the interview. So begin to tell us about your journey in and out of faith. So you are born into this Orthodox community.
And
yeah. And talk about like what was it like growing up in that area?
Mm-hmm. So being born in Riverdale, it felt very accepting. I had almost all of my other friends were Jewish. Most of them were Orthodox. I'd say maybe 30% of them were conservative and maybe 10% of them were Reform. The community was so insular that they didn't really want you to interact with people that weren't Jewish. So we'd, go to Brooklyn and stay in Borough Park and go to Queens and go to Flushing and really interact with our own kind. So because of that, that's really where I started to feel when I was, turning 8 or 9 years old, feeling a little, excluded from the general populace as a way of speaking. I went to Hebrew school 2 times a week, learned Hebrew and studied Hebrew with, what they call their big brothers, the rabbis that, scrutinized all of our work and made sure that we could read Hebrew appropriately and speak in front of people. But the main factor in my staunch religiosity was the fact that my family are what Jews call Kohanim. And Kohanim are a supposed group of people that are descendants from the brother of Moses, Aaron. Mm-hmm. And going, back centuries, I actually got my DNA tested a few weeks ago, confirming the presence of the Kohen gene in my DNA. So that's interesting to note. What a Kohanim is they're descendants of Aaron, and they are the priests of their communities. Mm-hmm. They are the ones that speak God's commandments and God's prayers to the other community members, and they're supposed to be vessels and vehicles for the actual voice of God, especially on the high holidays. So I was born as a Kohanim, and two as a New Yorker or an American. So it was a massive part of my identity and a massive part of my upbringing to ensure that everyone knew I was a Kohanim. Whenever I would enter synagogue, people would, bow down and ask me, to put my hands on their heads, and I would pray for them and, give them the Kohanim blessing that was entrusted upon me for 3,000, 4,000 years. So it was a massive part of my upbringing, my identity, my livelihood, my activities, every single thing that I did, Judaism and my belief in God, it intersected.
Mm. So when you talk about this, so for those of our listeners that may not completely understand, can you kind of give us a breakdown of what it looks like to be raised ultra-Orthodox, Orthodox, or fairly, I'm not even sure what the right term would be, but average Jewish? What is
yeah, yeah.
I mean,
of course.
I don't know.
So being raised ultra-Orthodox is or frum as frum as in Hebrew is one that most Americans see. You see them in all black. You see tzitzit or those white little fringes, mm-hmm. Hanging from their black coats. You see the payas, which is their long curly hair on their sideburns. The physicality of them is very stark. From a societal level, the men and women, they don't interact if they're not really married. Men and women do not touch. You think of Amish and you attribute a belief in the Abrahamic religion of Judaism to that, and you have Orthodox Judaism, really. Mm. They don't use electricity on Fridays evenings and Saturdays. They only, keep kosher. They stay connected to their roots when it comes to their community, to their Judaism. They really don't engage in anything that would be seen as, Western media. They obviously don't digest, pornography and, graphic imagery when it comes to television or movies or video games. They take a very early 20th century look and lens at life and embrace that. And then they see how that intersects with their belief in God and, make that their way of living. So that is the mainstream from Orthodox community. You have a much larger proportion of Jews being, you know, conservative or reform, those that don't keep kosher and can actually eat out at restaurants, and, you know, hold hands with the opposite sex, and they have dating, and they don't have arranged marriages like some, you know, Orthodox communities do. A much more liberal Western take, or, you know, liberal Eastern European take, for that matter, of Judaism. But the best comparison I can make is, you think of Amish that use a little bit of electricity some days of the week, and add a Jewish kind of spice to it, and you get, you know, ultra Orthodox.
And so how is it? So you're describing ultra Orthodox. So the step down to being Orthodox, what's the difference?
Well, I think the step down is fulfilling less mitzvot, which are, you know, the commandments that, you know, God or Hashem has, you know, provided the Jewish people. Things like interacting with the opposite sex, or actually engaging with non-Jews, or you know, being a little more lax on the religious aspects. And, you know, maybe they don't go to synagogue as much. Obviously, they go to synagogue every day, but maybe they don't, you know, spend 6 hours in the synagogue. You know, maybe they spend 2 hours and they go to Minyan's for, you know, 15 minutes instead of 3 hours. Call it Orthodox light, in a way.
So when you were mentioning, and I'm going to go ahead and just apologize in advance if I'm pronouncing this wrong. You were saying that you were the Kohalim.
Kohanim.
Kohanim. Okay. Yeah. So being, growing up, knowing that that is your identity, how heavy or burdensome is that on a kid?
Well, it was burdensome in the sense that I felt a need to believe in God, an innate need, a community-based need, and a societal need. Not burdensome, you know, when it comes to the fact that all of my family are also Kohanim because we're related. My brother is a Kohanim. My father is a Kohanim. There were a few other Kohanims in our communities, in Riverdale, for that matter. But it felt burdensome in the sense that I have a duty to preserve this religion, and I have a duty to make sure that everyone else knows what I'm talking about. So, you know, I had to do much more religious study than everybody else. All of my friends in Hebrew school, for that matter, had to make sure that I got, you know, better grades than everybody. And I had to make sure that, you know, I knew the appropriate prayers and when to say them, and the, you know, positions to put my hand and my head and my, you know, fingertips. You know, for the listeners that don't know this, Leonard Nimoy was a Kohanim, I believe, and he created the Live Long and Prosper hand. You hold your hand, you make that V for the Vulcan sign. That is actually the sign that Kohanim make when they say their prayer. So the V is the window at which, you know, God or Hashem speaks through. So that made me feel a little more connected to society at large, but I did feel a little, you know, secluded and a little, and like there was a lot on my shoulders. I thought I had to be a rabbi when I was younger, and I was told I was a Kohanim. Oh God, you got to be a rabbi. Great. That's going to be really interesting. It's still a weight, you know, even now, you know, when I go to synagogue now, and obviously people don't know my religious beliefs that much. They think I'm just a regular old, you know, Jew. I go to synagogue now, and people look at me. They go, "Oh wow, you're a Kohanim. Oh shkoyach. We gotta give you a handshake. We gotta get down on our knees, and we gotta thank you and ask for you to give us the prayers." Last time I was in, you know, Israel, I'm walking in the streets, and people notice I'm Kohanim through conversation, and they just stop. And you have to act a certain way. You can't, you know, degrade your family in a way. It's like a noble family from Game of Thrones.
I want to continue to kind of give a little window into this to the folks that are listening. And how is it that people know your status, you know, whether as a child or even you were talking about when you're, you know, walking down the streets, you know, in Israel, like how do people know he's the dude?
So very good question. My last name, in Hebrew, is Kohen Tzadok. So that actually means, you know, the high priest. Mm. So the direct translation of my name is passed down for, I don't know how many centuries, actually means Kohen. Mm. So it's on the one hand, my family, at least my father's side of the family, have wanted to have that name and be part of their identity, their innate religious identity. So they turned it into their, you know, their last name, I don't know, 1,000 years ago or something. So that's mainly why people know I'm a Kohen. Mm. It's Kohen Tzadok, which means the high priest or the son, the great son of Aaron, the brother of Moses.
So I've got a question for you that's totally off topic, that you made me think of as through this conversation. I recall back, this is back, and this is going to tell everybody how old I am. So I was working for a film production company back in 1999. And I was at the Sundance Film Festival back before it was a thing. So I was essentially a grunt for our producer director that was there. And so I'm like a, good Lord, I may have been like a 20-year-old that's getting drug around Park City, Utah. But the one thing that stuck with me was that, you know, we would go to different parties with producers or for production companies. And I would have people come up to me and ask me just casually, "Hey, are you Jewish?" They literally would. And I would be like, no, I'm sorry. And they'd be like, okay. And they'd leave. Like that was the opening and ending part of the entire conversation. And I don't really know what I'm asking for this, but you know, when you were mentioning about how people would know who you were, they would know your status. Does status matter a lot? Like, I guess when we're beginning to talk about the Jewish community.
Status within the Jewish community for congregations doesn't mean that much. Okay. Status outside of it is critical, I think, to the Jewish identity. You know, Jews get incredibly excited and overwhelmed with emotion when they realize that a large percentage of Nobel, you know, laureates and millionaires and people within media and people that have wealth and power in America and, you know, in Europe are Jewish. So comparing this community of people that have been beat down and exterminated and murdered and buried means a lot for them to have status when comparing it to non-Jews. So you do have a little bit of prejudice, you know, that comes with that. But when it comes to the actual communities themselves, when you're just talking about the insular communities, not really. Obviously, I've been in, you know, half a dozen congregations in my life, and obviously you have people look up at the president of the congregation with great, you know, status. They look at the rabbis and they hang on to every single word they say. But all the congregants, you know, really, there you walk into a synagogue and you're all Jews. You're all family members. You're literally all related. You know, it's literally like the people that I see at synagogue now, even in the South, they're my cousins, like genetically, like we share like 3% of our DNA. It's crazy.
That's one thing that I know I've talked about in the show before, and it was something that impacted me very deeply when I was going through seminary and being able to understand the rhythms of synagogue, because especially when we come to Christianity in America, Christianity is very divisive, it's divisive in many ways, but it's divisive also in the fact that we see that there are however many hundreds of denominations out there, you know, how many, you know, other types of spinoffs from denominations, and the way Christianity views things are you're either part of our small tribe, and if you don't believe X, Y, and Z, you're not part of this small tribe, even though you may still say that you're Christian. And that's been something that really has hit me about how divisive Christianity has become. Whereas I know when I was studying really just the rabbinical tradition, you know, that the tradition wasn't simply about that we all agree on everything. It came down to the fact of one rabbi may disagree with another rabbi and they can argue it out. And they still may walk away from that and be in different positions, but they're still part of the same family.
Yeah, it's you know, talking about arguments within Judaism. One of the main things that the majority of large denominations, like the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox and the Hasidic and the conservative denominations, agree on is, if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. Nothing about it. And if your mother's Jewish, then you're family. Yeah. Now, you have Reform individuals and congregations and communities that say, well, if your mother's not Jewish, but your father's Jewish, we'll still accept you as a full-fledged Jew. Yeah. But halakhically, which is, you know, the Hebrew word for lawfully or based on, you know, Torah or Hebrew law, to be Jewish is to have a Jewish mother and to be born from Jewish blood. Going back a little bit to what you said about, you know, if you have two, you know, rabbis having an argument about something in rabbinical literature, mm-hmm. One of the main things about Judaism that fascinated me and made me accept it a little bit more as a teenager is I believe one of the real only monotheistic religions that embraces critique. They say, let's think about what we're saying. Let's look at it through different lenses and actually question. Let's question God. You know, there are stories of you know, women in Judaism screaming at God and speaking to God as though they're higher than Him. It's a religion of questioning, of critical thinking, of high, deep self-reflection and intellectual thinking. Yeah. Which is why they stress education so much. You know, they instill it in their children through Hebrew school, you know, through Sunday school, through rabbinical literature and teaching, all the way until, you know, they're 18 years old. So that's what drew me to embrace it a little more when I was having doubts.
I would say that is such a beautiful thread that runs through Judaism, meaning that we don't have to agree. And like you had mm-hmm. said, that question and critique are almost at the core.
It literally is. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but one of my favorite quotes that I read and see in almost every single Haggadah or you know, Jewish Bible or Torah that I pick up is this quote that a lot of Jews embrace, and it goes something like, the atheist that is in his attic staring out the window is closer to God than those that believe in him. And it's this long-standing, centuries-old belief that it's okay to question, it's okay to think critically, it's okay to deny what you think is wrong and think for yourself. It's one of the main tenets of Judaism to critique and never stop critiquing, which I think is fantastic and, you know, helps mold really intelligent young minds.
No, I would agree with that, because I think that there's a certain danger in, well, not just in religion, when it comes to groupthink. I think there's a danger in humanity when we falter and lean into groupthink, meaning that, you know, that if you don't agree with 100% of what we're saying here, you must leave. And I love how you're describing this. I love how you're describing that there's a kinship, meaning that there's this kinship that you really can't shake. You know, that regardless mm-hmm. of what you believe or where you're at or where your belief system is at, you are still family. And I think that is a central tenet that has been lost in Christianity, meaning the fact that if you look globally at Christianity, outside of like the Western world, you begin to see a very simple belief system. If you look towards like the South American or the African or the like the Chinese Christians, like what unites them, they would say, do you believe in Jesus? Yes. Then we are
mm-hmm,
one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if you look at the kind of Western European or American Christianity, we're so divided. We are so at a spot where we're willing to throw somebody out at the drop of a hat. And
I don't mean to say that Judaism doesn't have that as well. You know, Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox communities, from communities, Hasidic communities, they're just like that, if not even worse. If you question, you know, the belief in God, if you question whether or not men and women should be able to touch or have premarital relations, you're not going to be accepted, and you're going to be told to shut up and sit down. And those types of communities that are much strong, that have those beliefs much stronger held in their communities, that keep their communities together and keep them, you know, a in the ghettos, so to say. It's very strong and very damaging and very prejudiced and extremely racist. So it's not to say that those types of communities, you know, don't have something very similar in common to you know, what Christianity is like in America. I'd say, you know, even worse sometimes. You have people in Borough Park that don't allow. I watched a video the other day of these Borough Park men beating up on a Hispanic man riding through a bicycle through their community because he wasn't Jewish. Not allowing him be there, you know, like them, you know, yelling at African Americans and Asian individuals, that even white men that they know that obviously aren't Jewish, and not accepting them in the community, and really not being accepting even to those Jews that, yes, do have Jewish mothers, but may not accept, you know, their you know, perspectives or thoughts on a particular topic. It can be extremely divisive. When I'm talking about this idea of critiquing Judaism, I'm really talking about what I identify really now with, which is the conservative movement, and the modern Orthodox movement.
Well, way to completely ruin my grass is greener on the other side perspective, Max. I appreciate that honesty, and I think that whole tendency towards tribalism is more of a human problem than it is than a specific religious problem. Yeah, I think that we find ourselves wanting to figure out who's in and who's out, because especially for those of us that are declaring who's in, we always make sure that we're in and that whoever's not like us is out. So it is a position of power. But what I wanted to move into, so you grew up in this Orthodox community. You had this status. You were in the lineage of Aaron. And when in
still
your
in
mind...
Still the lineage of Aaron, don't
yes,
forget.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Still very proud of it. I have a
Yo, I'm not... Well, if it's been said here on the show, you may be out. No, I'm kidding. but what I'm saying is, when did the wheels start coming off for you? Like, at what age did you start questioning?
That's a very good question. It started, I'd say, maybe 10 years old or so. When I really started thinking about philosophy, and my father would read to me Freud when I was, you know, younger. He would read to me, you know, Kant and you know, classical literature, and get really deep into, you know, Aristotle and Plato, and I would read these things, you know, as a young teenager as well, getting to 11, 12, preteen. And I honestly started thinking about what I believe, why I believe it. I was a staunch feminist as a child, and I, you know, staunch egalitarian. So I really identified as someone who in 2017, you would say, is a really strong liberal, you know, in the early 2000s. So I started thinking about why I feel these things. Why do I feel... then I have to think critically about things. Why do I feel as though everyone has to be equal? Why do I feel about all of this? And then I got to the belief in God. Why do I believe that God exists? And how did I form that belief? Well, I formed that belief because I grew up in an Orthodox community in Riverdale. Well, why did that happen? Because, you know, my parents did. And they did because their parents did. But what if their parents were born in, I don't know, Ethiopia? Certainly wouldn't be Jews. So I started having discussions with my father and my other, you know, Jewish friends who had similar, you know, views, and just really started feeling as though, wow, I'm making a special case for my beliefs. I accept things, you know, I accept things like I believe that all people are, you know, inherently equal. They should have the same rights. They should have the same, you know, ability to think and not have anyone trample that. And I take that because I believe there's good evidence for that. But when it comes to a belief in the divine, or a belief in the supernatural. I just say, oh, I believe it because I was taught to believe it. And I believe it because it's supportive of me emotionally and intellectually. It helps me, you know, thrive. I pray for something and then I see if, you know, something happens, you know, related to that prayer, I automatically attribute it to me praying, to, you know, for it. And as I got older and more critical and, you know, I got super heavy into science and physics and philosophy. And I wanted to be a biochemist. So I got really deep into understanding chemistry and physics. And I was like, wow, my beliefs of Judaism and religion don't align with my beliefs as to how the universe and the world works. Mm. I used to think of the old stories of Moses, you know, lifting up at Mount Sinai, or Moses, spreading the Red Sea, or a burning bush. And yes, although, you know, my parents instilled this, you know, belief in me that these aren't actual literal translations, they're more moral and philosophical translations of the text. You think, well, then isn't everything? Wouldn't everything be a, you know, simplistic way of just saying be good to one another, and everything is just it's not real. It's not the truth. So really when I turned 11 or 12, I started thinking about this deeply, and then decided, well, I can't make a special case for God and religion anymore because it's not fair to myself intellectually.
And how was having these types of beliefs, when you would have these questions, when you would have these doubts, when your mind was going in so many different directions, like morally, philosophically, how did that gel with the community that you found yourself in, especially with the status that you had in the community that you found yourself in?
Well, the community that I found myself in, you know, took me as a Jew because I was, you know, a full-fledged Jew. I never came out to them. Mm-hmm. I have to hide it, one, because I would lose all my, you know, friends, all of my connections, all of my networking opportunities. I would embarrass my family and my, you know, patrilineage line. They still don't know that I have the beliefs that I do. So it was so concerning to me back then to out myself and say, hey, I don't believe this, you know, right to the rabbis. I'm sure if I did it now, they would, you know, keep quiet. But if I did it then, it would be traumatic for everybody. Just because of the status and everyone knowing my family, it was this push and pull and this tug against, well, I need to be truthful to myself, and that means being truthful to everyone that I know. Mm-hmm. But if I do that, then I'm not going to know anybody anymore. You know, even today when I say I'm an atheist, or I'm a secular Jew, my parents say, no, you're not. Come on, you're a Jew. You believe in God. Well, I don't, but they still don't accept it.
Well, on those lines of you, because in the conversations we've had before, you've kind of talked about this. You've had a journey of belief, of disbelief, of belief, mm-hmm. back to disbelief. So we've kind of, as we're unpacking your story here, we've kind of gone through your belief. We've now stepped into your disbelief. And what moved you back again towards belief?
Yeah, what moved me back was a combination of factors. One, a desire to be more involved with the Jewish community, which then, you know, reaffirmed and reignited this flame of Jewish feeling in me. That made me actually feel connected to what I thought was God. I had a troubled childhood because what drew me away from belief, I'd say, is the failing health of my parents. I was like, wow, you know, my mother has a severe case of diabetes, and she would have, you know, seizures quite often, and she'd be very sick, and my father, you know, would have heart issues and be sick. And my brother, you know, has, you know, severe autism. So I had so many different physical and emotional problems as a child. I was like, wow, all this is happening. And I'm praying. I'm wishing for something, you know, to come out of this well. and nothing was. So it pushed me away from this. Wow, this is not how the world is supposed to work. If there was a God, then he or it would be fixing this. And then I lost my belief in God. And then things started to get a little better. And I was like, wow, maybe God does exist. I was, you know, pressured by my family to go to more synagogue, to engage with the community more, to really try to feel this through and try once more. So that briefly brought back my belief in God. Although it was a very strong belief that second time around, it was very brief.
And what stole that belief away from you again? Or, you know, what events happened? Because again, like, you know, you're kind of on this, and this is a very common thing for so many people, you know, where you're kind of there's an ebb and a flow towards going through these things. Mm-hmm. And as you're speaking here, you know, in your story, you're talking about how, you know, you'd lost something and then you regained it. And then what, you know, what was it? And it's probably not just one thing, you know, that led you back to where you are now.
I really don't know. I guess just reading, I got very deep into, internet communities for people that are, you know, closeted atheists, and reading their rationalizations for their lack of belief, reading, you know, texts from, you know, renowned scholars and essayists as to why they rationalize their lack of belief. Mm-hmm. And really coming to my own conclusions about what I think of the world. It's the exact flow that I had when I was 12 and 13, but just reignited again with this interest into critical thinking. And to trying to understand, well, why do I believe it? I obviously want to know the most true things that I can possible. So I need to make sure that I do that when it comes to my belief in God and belief in religion. So I just fell after like a few months of this real strong belief in God again into a serious lack of belief. That I still hold today. Mm.
And you'd mentioned this, and I want to see if you can help me, because this is something that I wrestle through as well. And you'd mentioned this in your last statement. You talk about your belief in God, and also your belief in religion. Do you see those as one and the same, or are they two separate things?
Well, I think religion can have massive benefits societally, community-wise. I see how it benefited me. I see how it benefits, you know, millions of other people. I understand the effectiveness of prayer when it comes to, you know, the psychological well-being of people. My belief in religion is that I understand why it occurs, and I understand why people believe that they do. Completely, it's not that I disbelieve religion, because you can't. Religion is a thing that obviously exists. And there's evidence for it existing because people believe it. But when it comes to the belief in God, it's a totally different thing. It's this abstract concept that everyone disagrees on, that because there's no evidence for, like there is evidence for religion, I can't come to accept the notion that it does exist. Mm.
And is there something, because I know that, you know, I really appreciate your story. I appreciate you sharing your story, because I think your story speaks to so many people, probably within the Jewish community and other religious communities as well, too. And as you have seen yourself, and this at least, maybe I'm putting this in my own words, and you can correct me if you want to, but it seems that you have been a person that is seeking truth in life. Would that be correct?
Seeking as much truth as I can. I don't believe there is some ultimate truth or there is some ultimate meaning in life, but trying to believe as many true things as I can, I think will lead me to lead the most fulfilling life that I can. Definitely.
So do you think in your journey, would there be something that could occur to you that would be one of those, you know, bright light moments, right? You know, where you've been seeking truth, you've been seeking, like, how does this connect in the world that you're in? How does this make sense in your perspective? Is there something that could happen that would push you to that place where you were able to say, oh my gosh, yes, there definitely is a God?
If I were given firsthand, you know, evidence or experience with some divine almighty, yeah, I'm completely open to it. I'm not going to take, you know, gospels written 300 years after, you know, the death of Christ to be evidence for it. I'm not going to be, you know, a secondhand experience from people that say that they've experienced God. Yeah, you have other people saying they experienced aliens, but other people don't, you know, accept that as evidence for the belief or for their belief in God. If God had appeared to me and I knew I was, you know, of sound mind, then yeah, of course I would. Of course I would believe. I wouldn't necessarily be happy, but I would believe nonetheless.
And I loved how you were laying that out, because I think this is a common thing. I think what's a common thing for any of us that would declare ourselves human, which would be hopefully most people that are listening to this podcast and radio show right now. When you begin to think about that, because this is something I've actually struggled with a lot, is you know, you'd mentioned if you had a personal experience with the divine, right? And so if you had that personal experience, that would help you to solidify what you believe. And when we begin to look across the religious spectrum in America, whether it be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, you could say Mormon, and fill in the blanks for all the other myriads of belief systems and thought processes that are out there. So when you think about that, how do you handle someone having a personal experience that you have not had, but that person believing in that personal experience so much? Like, how do you weigh that out?
It's a really good question. When I mean personal experience, I really mean one that can be verified by, you know, third parties too. If I, you know, saw some divine being right in front of me right now as I'm talking to you, I'd think I was crazy. If you had a dozen other people say, hey, I see this in front of you too, then I'd be like, wow, this may actually be occurring. I don't mean to say that, well, people that, you know, say they have first-hand experiences with God have a rational reason to believe, because I didn't mean like that. I mean it more like if you have an individual that can have other individuals kind of verify that they experience something, then it makes sense to call that a rational belief. One that's, that, you know, that's not just verified by the individual themselves.
No, that's good. I think that's a very measured answer, and a very well thought out one in that. And one of the things I wanted to kind of divert in our conversation to was to kind of pick your brain on a few things. Are you up for having your brain picked?
Yeah. I haven't had brain surgery in quite a long time, so let's get to this now.
I'm not a licensed brain surgeon, so the results may vary. So just be aware. But you have, you know, you've grown up in a country that likes to claim that it is a Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I'm pretty sure at different moments in your life, you've had Christianity pushed on you. Would that be a correct assumption?
Oh, for sure. Oh, okay. Yeah. To this day.
And so when you say, when you say to this day, do you mean that that's happening right now on the show?
It's happening right now.
Oh, man. Our thinly veiled evangelistic.
Hey, if you can convince me, I'd be happy.
No, that's not the point. That's not the point of what we're doing here. But within all of that, you have seen people preach and make claims from the Bible. And I know with most of your schooling has been focused what we Christians would call the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
What are American Christians getting wrong when they read these texts? Because one thing I've noticed, and it's one thing that's always bothered me about American Christianity, is the fact that we read our American lenses and our American values into these ancient texts. These ancient texts that have been translated from a language that most of us do not understand. And there's so much problem within that, you know, contextualization that we like to do. So, you know, in your best way, when you see Christians, especially, and you can speak to the New Testament if you feel like it, but especially when you see Christians reading the Old Testament, what are they missing? What are they getting wrong? What is being lost?
So I can respond in two ways. I can respond from an Orthodox Jewish perspective, and I can respond from my perspective.
How about let's do both?
Yeah. So from an Orthodox Jewish perspective, it's that the majority of things that occur within the Old Testament did occur. And the interpretations that Christians have regarding them are correct. But when it comes to the actual moral and philosophical teachings, they can be distorted. When Christians say things like they point to texts in Genesis, or they point to texts in the Book of Moses that say, you know, marriage is between a man and a woman, and slavery is okay, and you know, owning people and having multiple wives is okay. From a ultra-Orthodox perspective, yeah, that's right. It's strictly by the text, and there really isn't that much lost in the translation from Hebrew to English, or from Amharic to English. Not that much lost, but when it comes to the moral and philosophical teachings, things that go deep into Kabbalah or the mystical understanding of the Bible, they're not brought up at all. Mm. Things that delve into, well, yes, Orthodox individuals believe that Adam and Eve did exist. They believe that they did have relations with one another, and their children had relations with them to create humanity. It is the true Orthodox belief that actually occurred. But when you go down deeper into Jewish light, or modern Orthodox, or conservative, or Reform, or secular Judaism, you get more and more. It becomes more of a, these things didn't actually occur, but they mean things. They're ways that you can look at history, and ways that you should look at living your life through a lens that occurred 3,000 years ago, through a lens that makes sense for that time. But to tell you the truth, when it comes to what you know, modern Christians believe, when it comes to the Old Testament and what, you know, serious Orthodox Jewish individuals believe, it's not that far off. But like I said, when you get deeper into the smaller Jewish communities, the larger Jewish communities like conservative Judaism, it's less factually based and more philosophically and moralistically based.
And so I want to get to the Max perspective too in a moment. But one of the things I know, especially being raised around evangelical Christianity, there's this belief that the Bible, you know, Old and New Testament, are simply the spoken words of God. You know, meaning that, like, almost whoever wrote them down were some sort of an avatar for God, that He just had them write his words or whispered softly in their ears to tell them what to write down. And one of the things that's been formative for me is to begin to realize that these are books written by different people during different times with different angles on what they were dealing with and everything else like that. But if you were to ask most evangelical Christians, this is, you know, it's completely 100% the word of God. How would, like, especially growing up Orthodox, like, how do you view the separate books? Mainly speaking towards the Old Testament, like, you know, how do you view the differences in opinions, the differences in viewpoints from book to book?
That's a really interesting question. Well, when it comes to separating the distinct portions of the Bible or the Torah, in Judaism you have the oral Torah, and is comprised of the Mishnah and the Gemara, which come together to make the Talmud, and you have the written Torah. So laws and belief systems and thoughts and philosophical concepts and religious roles and prayers and customs and all these things that you're supposed to do that are within the Old Testament, they're either orally given from God to Moses and then from Moses to the people, or they're textually given from actually being written when they were conceptualized by God. The distinction between them is pretty strong, but the actual contents aren't really that different.
Gotcha. So what is a brief version of the Max version?
Of
how you were talking about, you know, earlier, you were giving me the Orthodox version.
Right. My belief is that these texts are indeed thousands of years old. We know they are. But they're just written from a small community of people that needed some signal in life and needed, you know, some way to separate their belief and what they thought was reality from the larger polytheistic, you know, belief systems of the time. So they felt as though God existed. They felt as though they had these experiences, and they, you know, obviously stretched the truth for quite a lot of it. I'd say more than half of it. We do know that quite a lot of things that actually occur within the Torah did exist. We do know that, you know, the Second Temple was destroyed. We do know that, you know, Jews were, you know, slaves in Egypt. We don't know that there was a mass exodus. There's no evidence for things like that. So I take everything that, you know, that's within the Torah, within the Tanakh, within the Talmud, within, you know, the Haggadah, as stories based on some factual events, but most of them made up. Mm. When it comes to, for example, my status as a Kohen, no, I don't think that I'm really, you know, the great whatever grandson of Aaron. But I do know through DNA analysis that I am the great grandson of some individual who a small portion of the Jewish population are as well. And we're all related. And you could find the genetic markers in our DNA that show that we're all related. So he may not have been Aaron, but he was somebody. And he was probably somebody pretty freaking important.
Well, Max, as we start to wrap this up here, what continues to draw you back to these religious communities?
Good question. As someone that would kind of self-identify, I guess, as a loner, to be a little more politically correct, I'd say an introvert. The true communities that evolve out of congregations from a religious standpoint are incredibly powerful. The connections that you can form, the people that you can meet, the opportunities that you can get occupationally, emotionally, relationship-wise are absolutely massive. Being able to walk into a place, just like, you know, you can walk into a church and, you know, hopefully feel connected, It's hard to do that, you know, as a Jew. I transitioned from, Hebrew school and being in a private school with 90% other Jews to being in a public school in the inner city where I was one of the only white Jews there. So feeling a need to belong in when you're obviously feeling, you know, secluded and not accepted is super important. And I even feel it now as I move to the South and the Bible Belt, where I do need to feel as though I'm with similar kind people that I, you know, can talk about my feelings when it comes to, you know, the holidays and not be laughed at or spit upon or, you know, stabbed or yelled at, because I have a different belief. You know, feeling connected and feeling as though you belong to a community is incredibly important for one to maintain their identity and their state of mind. And without it, I would be really distraught. Without Judaism in general, even though I'm a secular Jew, without it, I would have almost no identity. I identify more as a Jew than I do anything. And it permeates through my mannerisms, through my language, through my relationships, through my way of speaking, through my likes of food, through my appreciation of media. Every single thing that is about me is related to the fact that I grew up Jewish. And I think a lot of other, you know, Jews, especially from the New York kind of tri-state area, can see to that. It never leaves you. You know, like they say, if you have a Jewish mother, you're born to be a Jew. You are a Jew. Even if you convert, you know, to Christianity, religiously, you're still a Jew and you can never leave it. And I don't think I ever will be able to.
Well, that's it this week, and just wanting to wish everybody a happy and safe 4th of July. And as a reminder, as we end this broadcast, you can always catch us on podcasts at www.snarkyfaith.com, and I'll catch you guys again next week. I'm out of here.
WCOM is listener-supported community radio, and Snarky Faith is only possible through our sponsors. Aqueduct Conference Center was established in 1978 as a peaceful destination for small group meetings, special events, conferences, retreats, and weddings. For more information, go to www.aqueductcc.com. We are also sponsored by Lumen. Lumen, a spiritual community of seekers, sojourners, question askers, doubters, and skeptics, is a collective of fellow travelers that embrace the truth that all life is sacred, hope is real, and tomorrow can be better than today. All are welcome. You can find more information at www.lumencommunities.com.
Tired of fighting your kids to make their bed? Say hello to Betty's. The unique design lets your kids make their bed with just a zip. Our patented bedding includes everything you need, a fitted sheet, top sheet, and comforter in one seamless piece that zips together. Kids love the feeling of accomplishment when they can make their bed by themselves every day. Make your mornings easier and visit Beddys.com. That's BEDDYS.com.